Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Grace Wan. Tomorrow is the California primary. So much of the political news has been focused on Washington, but tomorrow, California, which has the world's sixth largest economy with a GDP of $2.5 trillion, opens its polls. All statewide offices are up for grabs, five propositions are on the ballot, and the question many are asking is, as California goes, so will the nation? And here in San Francisco, much attention has been given to the mayor's race and the role of ranked choice voting. But there are other issues on the ballot and elected offices to be considered. Tonight, we will be looking at the issues facing California and San Francisco as voters go to the polls. If all politics are local, what does this election mean for the Bay Area? Our guests tonight are Jason McDaniel, Associate Professor of Political Science at SF State University and an expert on urban politics and voting behavior, specifically in San Francisco mayoral races. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Joe Eskenazi, the managing editor of Mission Local and a former staff writer at the SF Examiner and a former senior editor at SF Magazine who specializes in local politics. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you kindly.
Finally, we have Sean Walsh of the Public Policy Institute of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research group. Mr. Walsh has advised two California governors and served in the White House staffs of George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
And in 20 minutes, we will invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. How will you be voting? What are the issues on your mind? We would love to hear from you. So, gentlemen, the California primary tomorrow, it's much been talked about. And I'd like to start with just framing the election for people. There's a lot of talk about the midterms and what California's role might be in that. Sean, can you kind of set the tone for us? What are the issues there?
Well, I think there was very high hopes at the national level that California was going to be the harbinger of a big Democratic wave, both in the primary election, then going into the November election. And there was a lot of excitement on the Democrat side until about a month ago. But the Democrats made some mistakes with the types of candidates they put up in some of the vulnerable congressional seats. You're seeing a number of folks that actually don't look like they're turning in their absentee ballots at a younger level. And because you have the jungle primary, which means the top two vote getters will then be running for office, you may see these seats that Nancy Pelosi was counting on and saying, the pathway for me taking back the House may not have any Democrats on it at all. You may actually have two Republicans in at least three of those seats down in Southern California.
And what districts are those, Sean?
That's in the ISA seat. That's in Dana Rohrabacher's seat. So they're all down in coastal Orange County, and that's in Mimi Walter's seat. So all nestled right around northern San Diego County, southern Orange County, and then going up in towards Los Angeles County.
Is that the result of the jungle primary, or is that because there hasn't been great voter turnout? What do you think, Jason?
I think those two questions are related. That's absolutely because of the top two primary, which is the what it's called. It was designed to, you know, voters in California distrust politicians and they distrust parties. And this is going to end up probably having a fairly undemocratic outcome when you have, you know, two Republicans making it to the general election when they're, most of the candidates are going to be, you know, plurality of votes for the Democratic candidates. It's tough for the Democratic Party to coordinate along with these candidates. And I think that's going to potentially cost Democrats a chance to take over the House in a time when they're going against a very unpopular president and a very popular party in California as a whole.
Is there anything that the Democrats, you think they should be doing right now to stop that from happening, or is it just too late?
I think they're doing a lot of what they, you know, can do. By design, the top two primary makes it, you know, difficult for them to coordinate, right? So they're supporting candidates where they feel like they can, you know, the sort of leadership is. But this is what it's designed to do. It's sort of designed to make the voters have to decide these things in a situation which is, I think, not very good for voters and not good for parties and not good for the candidates themselves.
For maybe some of our listeners don't really know what the jungle primary is. Sean, can you step us through that? How does that work?
Sure. So when I worked for Governor Schwarzenegger, he was concerned that it was too much partisanship in the state. So he backed a political reform where he thought that if we put the top two vote getters in, that would moderate the electorate. So you get moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats running for office. That was his intent, and you had other members of the legislature that went along with that. But the best laid plans of, you know, are in ruins now, because that's just the opposite that happened. The irony in this primary now is Gavin Newsom has actually been funding campaign ads for John Cox to make sure that he gets elected because he's worried about having a head-to-head runoff with Mr. Villaraigosa. Those ads actually, in a weird sort of way, if Cox becomes the number two vote-getter, which is highly likely that will be the case.
And John Cox is the Republican candidate.
He's the front-running Republican candidate. Mm-hmm. So what that likely does is it turns out voters in a higher level, because at the top of the ticket, people normally turn out for that party in higher numbers. So the fact that there's a survey done by the business community that showed that if a Republican was on the top two ticket persons, that the high propensity Republican voters would turn out around 85%. And if there wasn't a Republican, they turn out around 55%. So that may be the value number for the Southern California congressional races that are being contested and cost Nancy Pelosi the House. It's just crazy. Plus, the DNCC is actually paying for ads for Republican members running for Congress to try and undermine those Republicans and put their Democrat people forward. It's just crazy.
Does any other state have a jungle primary, Jason?
Washington has some aspects of it, right? And again, I don't love that phrase, jungle primary. I think top two is what we call it. And again, you're right. It was motivated by this idea of nonpartisanship. And what it does is had all these unintended consequences of confusing voters, confusing candidates, right? And people aren't able to transmit clear messages, you know, at the national and state level. And in fact, the research shows it hasn't made California candidates more moderate. It hasn't reduced polarization in the legislature. My own research shows that it actually hurts candidates who are women, which I think is the big story nationally right now, is the huge explosion in women candidates, especially on the Democratic side. And not only are they more of them running, more of them are winning than their male counterparts. And I think my research shows, again, that top two hurts women candidates. So I think it's, as a political scientist, I think top two is just about as bad as it gets.
And when you compare the top two to ranked choice voting, Joe, do you see any similarities there here in San Francisco?
Conceptually, I think that ranked choice voting has its critics. I don't think that we can point to it and say, oh, this is an unmitigated disaster. I think that, you know, both Sean and Jason will say this is the exact opposite of what we had intended. We can point to some things that came out quite the opposite of what the proponents of ranked choice voting wanted, but I can't say and that has had a deleterious effect on governing in San Francisco. I think that where the similarity might come in is that it's a confusing process that you know, I think can rise up frustration in voters because it feels like gambling. If you know, even though the proponents will say it doesn't, if you go in, I mean, certainly when you go in at ranked choice voting, you know, as a voter, you can make it very simple. I want this guy, I want that guy, I want that guy. But you also have to have an element of gambling in which who's going to be ahead after the one round? Who should I put ahead of the other person? And then when it gets to the permutations of actually tabulating ranked choice voting, it gets to be incredibly complicated because you have cascading waves of eliminations based upon the orders. And so that can make, quote-unquote, instant runoff voting take weeks to tabulate. I know that Mayor Farrell is expecting to be in power until mid-July. So this can be very complicating, and it can be a turnoff for voters who would want that pure 1-2 elemental race between Gavin Newsom and Matt Gonzalez, so you know what you're doing. And all voting forms have their limitations, but I would say that that ranked choice voting is an easy target because I don't think it satisfies anybody. And I think that the benefits have been a little bit harder to explain.
Well, it's interesting to think that, you know, so much attention is on California and this hope that, you know, the blue wave of California will go ride over to the east, to the East Coast. And it sounds like that's at risk right now.
I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, I think you'll see, again, the voters are reacting to there's not a huge amount of competition, right? At the governor's race is not in doubt. Gavin Newsom can finish first, right? The local race is a little bit different. I think you're going to see a lot of strong candidates from the Democratic side, and you're going to see a lot, perhaps, of some of the GOP candidates surviving that perhaps we didn't think, you know, were going to, right? You have some strong incumbents. They've been somewhat tacking away from Trump in some areas, right? So we'll see. I don't think it's going to be a rebuke to the national story. I think Democratic voters are still more energized, more enthusiastic to vote in November. I don't think California, there's any story that will change that coming out of this state tomorrow.
What do you think about the voter turnout for tomorrow, Sean, here in the Bay Area? High, low?
Well, I think probably pretty low. I think there was an expectation there was going to be a higher level of excitement than I think that is at least currently being brought forward, at least on the absentee ballots that are being turned back in. The millennials are voting in very low numbers, and the people 50 and older are voting in higher numbers, and that's generally fairly typical. The one thing I would add, though, going back to the professor's comments, in the past 120-odd years, There has only been two times in history that the sitting president's party actually gained seats or retained the number of seats. So every other off-year election, the sitting party has actually lost seats. So the trend should be pretty strong with the Democrats, particularly with the, you know, pink hat and the resist and the old nine yards. But there are a few things that are working against the Democrats now. I mean, the economic numbers are actually very, very good. And the Republicans were in a near full-blown panic in January, just in a panic. And now they feel things have somewhat stabilized, and now you're getting back to, instead of the wave of anger and angst, because President Trump really isn't on the ballot. I mean, people want to make him on the ballot. But it's getting down to individual economic decisions in areas, and the Republicans, at least, that I'm talking to in the polling showing, and Democrats who are friends of mine also say it's not the slam dunk that we once thought it was. So it's a real question about whether they get over the hump and Nancy Pelosi takes back the House.
It's, you know, interesting. You know, you're absolutely correct. Only two presidents have gained seats, right, or not lost seats. This year, November is not going to change that, right? President Trump will lose seats. His party will lose seats in the House, maybe in the Senate as well, given that. You know, the president is the most unpopular president at this point in their presidency in the history of, you know, polling, and despite a good economy, right? I don't think that, you know, there's also research that shows that some of the polling right now and the generic ballot showing Democrats are ahead. They're not as ahead as much as they were a couple of months ago, but that's actually a pretty natural trend. We see that in the summer of the election year. So again, I expect a very strong showing by the Democrats in November in terms of the House, possibly taking the Senate as well. And it will be a commentary on President Trump. There's no doubt about that. All the research shows that is exactly how voters are seeing this election.
So let's talk about who might emerge out of the primary on the statewide offices. To any of you, who do you think is going to be on the ballot for governor?
I think the ballot for governor right now, barring any major get-out-the-vote effort on the Latino votes, it's going to be John Cox and it's going to be Gavin Newsom. And then it's basically a slam dunk for Gavin Newsom. Now, I believe if Antonio Villaraigosa actually made the ballot, that you would see a very large number of NPPs and you would see a large number of Republicans actually support Villaraigosa. So I think if Villaraigosa ran statewide, he's got a pretty good job of beating Gavin. So I think that's why he pulled out all the stops to make John Cox his running mate.
Agree, disagree?
I think that's definitely where the smart money is. I think that we can argue about a process in which which one promotes John Cox over Villaraigosa because of self-serving fears. But, yeah, that certainly seems to be where things are going.
I mean, for me, it's interesting that it's possible that there's going to only be one Latino candidate on the ballot in November, right? It could be Javier Becerra running for attorney general. I think that's interesting, an interesting factor. And I think it's the top two primary is a big reason for that, right? And so I think that's, you know, probably just a historical accident, but it is something that I think is not something that California, I would expect in California, given the number of Latino voters and the expected rise in their turnout.
Well, you had mentioned, Jason, that top two voting might hurt women candidates. Are you saying that it also hurts Latino candidates?
I don't have research on that. That's the next project. but the idea is that it's those candidates that are perceived. It seems to be white male candidates that are tended to perceive to be stronger candidates by other candidates, right? On the Democratic side. The Republican side, there's differences, but it seems like they attract more competition, right? That the women candidates are perceived to be weaker for some reason, right?
Yeah.
That seems to be what my research is showing, but also because women are more likely to perceive the barriers to their winning, right?
Yeah.
And so fewer women run under the top two than before because they expect they'll face a tougher race.
Mm-hmm. Sean, did you want to share something?
I do. Something very important. So there's, in this state, a natural schism between North and South. And, you know, Northern Californians think that Southern Californians are stealing the water. The Giants hate the Dodgers. The Dodgers hate the Giants.
They don't really care about us, but we hate them.
Indeed. And actually, that's very true, and you're exactly right. There is a lot more antipathy for Northern Californians to Southern Californians.
Because they are stealing our water.
They are. The real interesting thing here is, does Latinos, with Latinos, is very, very much underperforming in Northern California. And he's doing okay in Southern California, but he has to do at least 3.5 or 4 percentage points higher. And he's not performing that high there or as well as that high in the southern part of the state. So the real issue is Latino voters may actually cost Antonio Villaraigosa the election because of lack of enthusiastic, fervent support. So It'll be very interesting to see.
And less scientific than what Sean is saying. And I've talked to a lot of, you know, high-level political people in San Francisco who are not fans of Gavin Newsom but would vote for him over Antonio Villaraigosa because of the perception that Gavin will look out for Northern California and that you know, right now the power structure in California is very much slanted towards Northern California. We have both senators. And we have we have the governor, and we'll have the next governor. So the perception is that Antonio Villaraigosa will be, you know, if not bringing the bacon back to Southern California, will certainly be more focused on Southern California issues. So it's something people really do think about, if not when they're voting, certainly when they're making their big donations.
I would say that it's actually a culture, a long culture here of the Bay Area and in Northern California, of a more turnout-oriented culture, right? People tend to be a little higher level of education, a little higher level of money, right? Those things over you know, decades really matter, right? The Northern California voters turn out at higher rates than most voters in Southern California, right? It's not just Latino voters. It's Southern California voters in general. There's not as much of a culture of participating in politics in Southern California. I'm from Southern California, so I know
those
that.
Those might be, right? Fighting words, Jason. I don't know. Or voting words.
Well, perhaps. But I would also say that, you know, Joe talked about Northern California politicians winning, you know, senators, governors, that the real schism in California politics now is, you know, it's not as much North versus South. It's Coast versus Central, right? And those politicians that win statewide, you know, people in Southern California also feel, Democratic voters especially, feel like they're well represented by them, right? And so I don't think the schism North versus South is as much as it used to be in the era of Dick Majan or Reagan before that, right? I think it's very much a coastal, inland Democratic vote versus a more purple, Republican vote than versus some of the deep red further out of the coast that you get.
Well, I would say that Devin Nunez is probably one of the least favorite politicians in Northern California, but it looks like he's set for November.
It's unclear. I think things are looking much better for the Republicans in Southern California. I still think the immigration issue and the fact that he is actually doing a full court press to try and push Paul Ryan and actually doing an immigration vote is pretty telling, the fact that he's nervous about his race. So I'm hoping that, as a Republican analyst, I'm hoping that he does pull it out, but I do think he's still in a little bit of a danger zone.
Let's talk a little bit about the propositions on the ballot. Most of them, there are five of them, and they seem to be funding measures. Sean, do you want to give us a quick overview of what they represent?
I think of the three that really matter. One, you've got a kind of an appetizer for the big one that's coming up in November, but you've got about $4.4 billion park and water and environmental bond that's going out. And then you got the monster bond that's almost $9 billion coming out in November. There's a real issue there because, once again, there's a lot of folks who think this is a little bit of a bait and switch, because every time we talk about doing water, it's all about environmental restoration, about habitat, but not off-stream storage capacity with two dams that have been planning stages for a long time, nor even underground storage capacity. So that's an issue. The second issue that's somewhat interesting, rainwater. So Prop 72, they want to make rainwater catching so you can do water recycling environmental issues not subject to increases on your property taxes. I'm not sure you need to do that statewide, but that's on the ballot. And then the third issue is there was concern with the cap and trade with regards to where all that money was going to go and how it was going to be spent. So they put to cover Chad Mays and the Republicans that went for that and actually cost them their political positions, put some sort of measures to control how that money is spent, and there's some regulations on that. So that's it. The heavy stuff is in November. That's where you're talking about the labor unions are thinking about putting a split roll ballot measure forward. So as opposed to just having taxes go up, or taxes would then be pegged to current market rates for businesses. So that's the huge, huge fight. And so Gavin Newsom wants to fund, I think if he does single payer, go through that. The teachers unions really want that. And as I mentioned, the bond going in November for the big water bond. So that's the bonds.
Any thoughts from either of you?
I mean, I expect, most of those are pretty boring and they'll probably pass. There's not a lot of opposition, and generally voters follow those signals and they'll probably support them.
People like parks. People like water.
I think so. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Jason McDaniel, Associate Professor in Political Science at SF State, Joe Eskenazi, the Managing Editor at Mission Local, and Sean Walsh from the Public Policy Institute of California. We invite you to call in with your questions. How will you be voting tomorrow? What issues are on your mind? The number to call in is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org. And you can reach us on Twitter by using our handle at cityvisionskalw. Joe, let's bring it local. Let's talk a little bit about the mayor's race. Can you let our listeners know the top three candidates and what the issues are?
Well, the top three candidates are President of the Board of Supervisors and former Acting Mayor London Breed, and you have former State Senator and Assemblyman and Supervisor Mark Leno, and you have Supervisor Jane Kim. And the issues are, you know, are what you'd think they would be in this day of San Francisco. It's housing, it's homelessness, it's quality of life crime. You know, and it's also just, you know, kind of the unspoken affordability issues. You know, can San Francisco become everybody's city again? And you know, and whoever convinces people that they can do that or even make a dent will be in a good position tomorrow.
Well, homelessness, as you mentioned, is a hot topic for each of the candidates. Where have they each staked a claim on a solution to that issue?
London is putting a lot of her chits. She's kind of she and Scott Wiener are mostly talking about conservatorship, which is depending upon how you feel about this, you would frame it as taking away people's civil rights or looking after people who are being benignly neglected. Such as, you know, I mean, we can come up with a million examples of people who you can't believe are being allowed to do what they do on the streets because it's harmful to themselves. But many court precedents and relatively recent state law won't let you really take someone off the streets against their will or committed against their will by family, as used to be the case, unless they present a clear and present danger to themselves and others. And even you know, for lack of a better word, truly maniacal behavior and disturbing behavior like you might see in the library or on a bus, it does not qualify. So, you know, a lot of what London is going to do is trying to, I guess, you know, loosen up the conservatorship rules, which is something Scott Wiener's working on the state level. And this is popular across a number of lines. You know, for example, Raphael Mandelman running as the quote-unquote progressive in District 8 seems to have generous thoughts towards it. He had to get a conservatorship on his own mother. So, you know, there are compelling narratives here. Mark Leno has put a lot of his chits into getting homeless people into the housing that we've got. And the housing that we've got is single-room occupancy hotels, and a lot of what he wants to do is try to compel the owners of privately owned SROs to house some of these people. In my own research and with the city's numbers, there's at least 1,800 rooms that are sitting vacant in single-room occupancy hotels, probably well more than 2,000 because a number of the hotels didn't even bother to fill out the surveys. The question is, can you make them do this? And broadly, you cannot because it's private property. So, you know, it takes, you know, Mark Leno is a very diplomatic fella, and that would take a lot of diplomatic behavior. Jane Kim's major take on homelessness is to make it more of a health crisis type issue than a health and human services issue. This would put it more under the aegis of Department of Public Health. You would have more doctors, nurses, et cetera, dealing with this as opposed to administrators of another sort. And so the Human Service Agency, which handles general assistance and things like that, would have a lesser role in homeless reaction. It would be more a health issue now.
A lot of the conversation about the mayor's race is that there's not that much difference between the three candidates on issues, so we're really talking about thin slices of difference. Where do you see ranked choice playing in this, Jason?
Well, I mean, I think it's very possible that you're going to see someone who does not finish in first place, you know, have the most number of first place votes actually end up winning the race.
Right? I think that both Jane and Mark are counting on that.
Right. And so I think it's quite possible you're going to see London Breed, and I think this could be a national story, right? An African-American woman winning the mayor's race in a multiracial coalition supported by, you know, Chinese and Asian-American voters, supported by, you know, older white homeowners, especially African-American communities. Strongly in support of her, this could be a very positive story of racial coalition building across racial lines, leading a city into the future. Or it could be a situation where, you know, she finishes in first place after that first round of voting and then isn't the winner. because of second and third phase voting. And I think that that will incredibly upset her supporters, a lot of her supporters, and it might be a crisis for ranked choice voting going into the future.
Right. And we've seen that in Oakland, right, in the Oakland mayor's race, right, Sean?
Well, I will tell you, I'm an Oakland resident, and I think when people went to bed that night, no one thought that Gene Kwan was going to be their mayor, and they woke up and Dandy Don Parada was shocked that that occurred. And I will tell you that I think, except for these two gentlemen here, there's probably five other people in the city of San Francisco that really fundamentally understand ranked choice voting. I think it's very, very confusing to your average voter, and I think you'll have some voters that will come out and be very surprised if Ms. Breed is not the mayor of San Francisco. And
I think they might, but they can't really claim. I mean, everything I think about now relates to the Warriors, right? So you can't really claim a referee's conspiracy when against Cleveland, when Cleveland is given the two game-winning free throws at 4 seconds left. And similarly, I think that you're right, Sean. I think that if you try and explain how the system works, the same way if you open up the hood of a car and try and explain what all the parts do, that's complicated. If you explain you push on the gas and you go, like, people will get that. So I think that, people who are intellectually curious can understand how to do ranked choice voting. Once you get a little bit deeper, it becomes complicated if you're trying to vote against someone rather than for someone, for example. And you have to figure out, there becomes some gamesmanship involved. But I don't think it has to be fundamentally complicated. I don't think it's an illegitimate system. I've seen it described, I even myself said gambling, but that's not, it's not random. It's not ping pong balls or anything like that. This all makes sense. It's just, it might be too complicated once everything's said and done. Yeah. But going into it, you don't have to think of it that way.
Yeah. If I may, there's three things I'd say to that, right? Mm-hmm. About it, it's certainly not an illegitimate system, right? But just like what we saw with Gene Kwan in 2010 in Oakland, we might see that this time around. I think it fosters doubts about the legitimacy of the winners, right? Because of the way the votes are allocated. And so I think we saw some of this with Ed Lee. People felt like he was more somewhat illegitimate, some of his opponents did. And I think it's because they saw him only get sort of 30 some odd or 40% of the vote. Two, positively, I think we've seen a pretty positive campaign here. And I think that it's because of ranked choice voting, right? Mm-hmm. The research shows that candidates perceive the pressure to be more positive in order to appeal to their opponents, supporters, and get those second and third place mm-hmm. votes. And the third thing is my research shows that confusion, I do think, on the margins, reduces turnout a little bit and increases the number of ballots that are cast in error a little bit as well. These are relatively small numbers, but it's significant in terms of my research, and I think that's unfortunate as well.
Yeah. Well, let's take a call. We have Ruth Ann. Ruth Ann, are you there?
Much so.
Hello.
To ask the panelists their opinions on RM3, Regional Measure 3, the increase in the bridge toll, $3 every so many years.
Yeah. Sean.
Sure. So the bottom line is it requires the seven counties that actually touch on a bridge to vote in a majority for that. There is candy and goodies and presents for every county, so it includes widening roads in some areas like the 101 up in Marin County. It includes more BART trains. It includes BART down to San Jose. I don't think it's unreasonable to actually put a dollar forward up until 2025, where you get $3 numbers. If you look at bridges in other major metropolitan areas like New York, that's acceptable to do. It's a way of putting funding forward. And you can arguably make the case that less cars in the Bay Bridge help and benefit car drivers if you have more BART trains. And the bottom line is there needs to be mass transit funding. The mass transit doesn't pay for itself, but there's community benefits. So I think you'll probably get this thing passed. But again, getting seven counties all to go forward is questionable, but I think doable, and the economy is going so well, so I think you're on a good tailwind.
Well, actually, I would have called you up in my professional life to ask this question, so now I've got you sitting across the table. How is it not regressive to tax the guy who's driving in from Antioch because he can't afford to live in the city, mm-hmm. but not tax, an engineer and a software developer living in the city who can take a scooter to work?
It is regressive. I mean, the bottom line, though, is that the city of San Francisco is a magnet for people's jobs. And I would argue that if a person is spending 20 minutes less coming to work each and every day, well, number one, if they're taking public transit, they're being subsidized anyway. So if you're a mm-hmm. working person, you're coming in from Pittsburgh or Antioch, you're being subsidized anyway. Number two, the people are driving on the Bay Bridge. If they are paying the tolls and the gas and everything else, chances are they can probably pay for it or they can do it at a carpool. So, in an ideal world, you would say, well, San Francisco is getting huge benefits from this for restaurants or other sorts of things. But I think it, you know, as a Republican, people say, oh, gosh, you're just putting another tax on people. But the bottom line is you got to pay for these things somehow. And this is probably the least of evils. And I do think it helps people who work in the rural or suburban areas come into San Francisco and helps them get there in an easier way.
Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking about the California primary with our esteemed panelists. We've got Jason McDaniel, Associate Professor in Political Science at SF State, Joe Eskenazi, the Managing Editor at Mission Local, Sean Walsh from the Public Policy Institute of California. We invite you to call in with your questions or your comments. How will you be voting? What issues are on your mind? Give us a call at 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or reach us by Twitter at cityvisionskalw. There are many ways to get in touch with us. We have a call from Straley in San Francisco. Hello? Are you there? I think we lost him. Hello? Yeah, I think we've lost it, unfortunately.
Call back.
We're here to take your questions. So we were talking about the mayor's race, and let's talk a little bit about the local ballot measures in San Francisco. Let's start with C and D. We've seen a lot of political ads about them. Joe, do you want to explain to our listeners what those are two?
It's very hard. and this is another thing. Like, this, too, is a multifaceted thing where voters can decide which one they like better, but there is a backstory that may or may not inform your decision. What this does is that it greatly increases commercial real estate tax. Currently, it's at a very low rate of 0.3%. C would raise it up to, I believe, 3.2%. Is that it? No, 3.4%, because it's double what Prop D is. And it would apply to early childhood education, and it would pay some of the educators. And, you know, as someone whose entire salary – and I'm not joking with you. My entire salary will go to child care. I understand the motivation here. D goes towards housing and homeless issues and also middle income and plenty of carve-outs. It taxes at a lower rate, only 1.7%. And this one has the blessing to, if not support, not denigrate – from the downtown business community. There is a backstory here. Now, first of all, people will vote for, you know, are being asked to pit one against the other, two worthy causes here. This shows a failure of government, period. There's blood on a lot of hands here. This should not have been put before voters. We should not be asked to decide. That's a failure of government. It's a failure of the people who put forward C. It's a failure of people who put forward D. It was a failure of the acting mayor not to get them together. And that's because it is a political football. C can be used to advance the political goals of Jane Kim, who is the most prominent sponsor. D can be used to advance the political goals of London Breed, most prominently, and Asha Safai and Jeff Sheehy. The advertisements for D have those three politicians bigger than the words yes on D. It is not – no one is being fooled here. No one should be fooled. That is what's going on. You can do good and do well at the same time.
What happens if they both pass?
They won't. But because C, and this gets complicated here, this is like Dungeons and Dragons stuff, because C was put onto the ballot by signature gatherers, it only needs a majority to pass, 50 plus 1. Because D was put on by the legislative process, and because it is a tax, it needs a two-thirds majority. It's very unlikely that's going to happen. And here's where things get even gnarlier, is that arguably, both have poison pills. Jane Kim will argue that hers does not, but definitely D does. And D has a double poison pill. And this will answer your question, Grace. The poison pill in this one says if D gets more votes than C, it nullifies C. But also, if C gets more votes than D and they both pass, D vaporizes. And that way the business community is double taxed. Now, you'll notice that, like, there is, you know, if you're getting mailers, and I have enough mailers to build a fort for my children, is that there's a committee called No on C and D. But they're only targeting C. They only mention C in the advertisements. It's very hard for me to believe that that's a coincidence.
Right.
Very hard.
Interesting. Well, we have a caller on the line who I think wants to talk about dark money in politics. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, I am. Regarding the mayoral candidates, what do we know about dark money? Who's pulling the strings?
We know a fair amount. And, you know, again, we can also argue as to whose strings are being pulled. Is somebody the puppet of their donors, or do they just choose to align themselves with those donors? And in the end, does it matter for you as a voter if the policy is coming out of the same? You know, these are things.
So
to
you're
think
suggesting
about.
Mm-hmm. that they would take money and then not do the bidding of the donor?
I'm suggesting that they were inclined to do the things that they were going to do anyway. I don't know if their will was going to be changed. I don't know if in the end that matters to us on the business end. The policies are happening. You know, for example, if you have candidate X who's very inclined to do what Airbnb wants, and Airbnb comes with lots of money, it's not like that person was instead going to do something, you know, that would counter Airbnb. There may be, you know, it may be a matter of this almost seems like a religious discussion about free will. In any event, though, I recommend going to the SF Ethics webpage. You can see a lot. You know, late donations. You can see who's dumping tens of thousands of dollars into this race. A lot of corporate money, a lot of tech money, a lot of real estate money. And, you know, a lot of it is going behind, you know, a Supervisor Breed. And again, I think it is simplistic to say Supervisor Breed is the puppet of her donors. I think that those donors see her as the best choice for them. You know, and on the other hand, I don't think that it's, you know, a racist or a sexist thing to say that, you know, that this relationship is happening any more than it was racist to say that Ed Lee was getting that money. You know, that's happening. There's a fair amount of tech money going to Jane Kim as well. She's gotten some $100,000 donors. So we can see who's doing that. You know, that's the outside money is a big factor here. But also the candidates are spending a lot. You know, when you look at how many votes they're going to be, and I'm hearing estimates of 32% to 35%, high-end 50%, I don't see that happening. I do know that there were 30,000 ballots that dropped in the last 6 days alone. But, you know, they're spending a lot per vote.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agree that they're spending a lot per vote, right? And if they had more money, they might be able to drive turnout up even higher, right? And I also would like, I think it's important to distinguish between dark money. I hear that phrase used a lot, and I think they mean any money that's sort of spent by people they don't like, right? Or by corporations, perhaps, where dark money is a specific thing, right, where we don't know the donors.
And
right?
there is actually hundreds of thousands of dollars of literal dark money coming right. from the Safe and Affordable San Francisco PAC, which, and this may be even too nitty-gritty for what's going on here, but because of specific rules regarding spending by a state committee on local races, it does not have to reveal its donors until July, well after the election. Now, and you know, just very clever gamesmanship or dirty pool, depending upon where it lies, but they dumped $100,000 into anti-Leno ads, which were incredibly schlocky and had his face on a baloney ad and all that kind of stuff. And they dumped $50,000 into anti-Jane Kim ads in the Chang's Language Press, which one of the quotes actually translates as Jane Kim, tax, 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 tax. Today I'm seeing that they also dumped, let's see, what did they do? Yeah, they are the ones that put out the, that claimed that Jane Kim and Mark Leno are taking money from evictors, tying them to Veritas, because Veritas gave money to the Democratic Party, which supports Jane Kim and Mark Leno, and also, I suppose, oxygen for breathing and water for drinking. So,
well, Sean, let me ask you this. I mean, I think if you're a voter in San Francisco, you're getting inundated with lots of flyers and ads. Do they work?
Yes and no. So there is some scientific, quasi-scientific at least, how much voter contact you actually have to have with the person and how important that issue is. So usually something that really pushes your button, you need less voter contact. Something that's you don't really understand about, you need a lot of voter contact. So an interesting dynamic. This election cycle actually is where people are texting you messages that show up on your phone. It's Pavlov's dog. So your little button dings, you see one sentence, and it's believed that actually voter contact is somewhat effective. I think it's annoying people and will have a diminishing returns. But it depends really on the issue. But the bottom line is direct mail pieces are really probably the most affordable way of actually getting your message to somebody in their living room, as opposed to really expensive television ads. So, yeah, they're effective. And if they weren't effective, people wouldn't do it.
Go ahead.
Well, they're more affordable, but they're actually the least effective of all the methods we've seen mailers are, right? And I think people, it's intuitive. It makes sense, right, that they get a ton of them, you know. Look, all the research shows that most of these campaign mailers or what have you just don't persuade voters, right? Mm-hmm. And all the money just tends not to persuade voters either, right? Yeah. It's that they may be at most reminded to support the person they probably already would have anyway,
right?
That's why I think a lot of, you know, I understand why people think and worry about money in politics, but I actually think a lot of the coverage increases the cynicism about our elections and our politics. I think we have too much cynicism about our elections, right? And I think as much as I respect Joe's reporting, and that information is important, you know, who's giving the money, I think we have a tendency to assume then that the politicians are being bought, rather than seeing that perhaps, yes, they're supporting politicians that are maybe the best of their choices, but those politicians' positions aren't changed by the money. In fact, it's the interests who are often shaping and compromising their positions to go along with the politicians they're supporting, right? And so I'm a lonely voice on this, but I think I'd like to try to reduce some of our cynicism in our politics and about our elections.
I disagree with Jason on this, but respectfully so. I think that the donations serve as the true version of endorsements. I think that endorsements to me are just back scratching. I think that money is like a truer version of endorsements. I think that trying to tie someone's motives to money is often very difficult, and usually it's not as easy as when Leland Yee was involved, where it's almost out of a bad movie. I wouldn't have written dialogue like the dialogue of where the pan puts the envelope full of money on the table and Leland Yee tells his underling, "Take that."
Yeah. So we're having a spirited conversation about the primary here on City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Jason McDaniel, Associate Professor in Political Science at SF State, Joe Eskenazi, Managing Editor at Mission Local, and Sean Walsh from the Public Policy Institute of California. Call us with your questions or comments. That's 1-866-798-TALK. 1-866-798-8255. We have a caller on the line from San Francisco. Carl, you had a question?
Yes. The question I had for the panelists is, are there any kind of significant issues that you think the mayoral candidates are not addressing out of political expediency? Is there anything that's kind of a glaring issue that none of them are willing to touch?
Yeah, I can think of one right off the bat, and that's the incredible situation at the Hunters Point shipyard. I think that's the biggest story in the city. It might be the biggest story in the West Coast.
Tell us a little bit about that story.
You have nearly 100% faked radioactive testing on the former Hunters Point shipyard, which is slated to have the majority of the houses that Ed Lee and others wanted to build in order to start to alleviate the housing crisis in this city. And what's more, there could be the houses that are already there could well be atop radioactive land. The land that was in front of the former radiological laboratory is a de facto nuclear waste dump. No one even knows what's in it. And what's more, there's been generations of economic racism. This radioactive material was willy-nilly just dumped out there, and you know who was living in Bayview Hunters Point. So this is A, there's that issue to address of endangering people's lives for generations. But also the fact is that this is where the bulk of your future housing is supposed to go. And now there's a great degree of uncertainty there. So you have to address that. You can't talk about how many units are in the pipeline anymore because the pipeline is radioactive. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that has to be addressed. I was very surprised by Mayor Farrell's about face on this, where within the course of 1 week, he told the Chronicle, "I wouldn't buy a house there," and then went to leading a tour with the paper of record saying, "Oh, I'd buy a house there."
Interesting.
So this is a confusing issue, and this is something that I think needs more play.
Well, it looks like we'll be hearing more about that. Sean, is there an issue that we're not talking about in the mayor's race that we should?
I'm not sure so much about the mayor's race. I would say actually just regionally and at a statewide level, we have massive, massive underfunded pension liabilities, both from a health care perspective as well as from a retirement benefit perspective. It is absolutely the Titanic, and it's in every city and every county. And the local governments are just not setting aside the money they need to do, and they're not being honest with the people. And, we have an economy right now that's generating revenues off the charts. And yet, there's a Stanford study that says that the underfunded liability is around $1 trillion, $1 trillion. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but the bottom line is those chickens have to come home to roost. So either the politicians have to do something with rebalancing that, or they need to start putting real money aside to address that issue.
I can tell you locally that the unfunded health care liability is even worse. So this is a big deal. He's exactly right.
I would argue that it's also the reason why the governments are maybe not telling us the full story is they know the voters don't want to hear it. Right, it's up to voters as a group to stand up and accept truth and tough questions, right, and maybe make some of the tough decisions about Prop 13, for instance. It's not just on the governments to slash funding. It's about whether we as a state, as localities, can make those tough choices ourselves and not just blame politicians.
And here's why it matters, because at some juncture, you can only borrow so much money, and the bond rating agent, I won't bore you with bonding politics, but or bonding policy, but you can only borrow so much, and you, when you bond, that has the first cash call, et cetera. So if you have a higher and higher and higher call on your revenues going to pension issues, you can't build schools, you can't build bridges, you can't build roads, because you're limiting how much money you can then apply to those issues. So it's really, really, you know, acid to the state of California at the city, local, and county levels for what we need to do for a very tired and aging infrastructure in the state.
I see two future shows right there. We have a call on the line. Karen in Berkeley?
Yes, good evening. I wanted to know if you knew who the developers were that have already sold townhouses on the upcoming development on Hunters Point. And I don't think that they, the city mayor or any of the people in there were planning on building low-cost or affordable housing out there, because it's what I read was that that was already going to be market-rate townhouses on the radioactive property.
Well, the developer's Five Point, which is a closely associated company to Lennar, which is one of the biggest home builders in the country and has deep political ties with San Francisco political powers. I don't know about what she just said with regards to affordability. I do know that there was a pretty good affordable component in the forthcoming development. You know, you can argue whether it's enough, but it was a pretty good percentage, as you would expect, of land that the city essentially controls. You can drive a harder bargain with affordability. But that's all going to be for naught if it's on top of radioactive soil. Eventually, you would think this would get fixed, but you know, time is money, and the housing crisis is serious. And you know, you've just lost your Steph and your KD. I told you basketball when it comes to the land that you've got. So you know it's a fairly dire situation.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about another topic I don't think is as talked about by the mayor races is education. There is a local ballot measure, a parcel tax to – I think that's Proposition G.
Correct.
But what are the mayoral candidates saying about the educational system in San Francisco?
Not much, because they don't control it. And, you know, one of the few things that that elected officials can do is build playgrounds. That's so they get really worked up about it, even as we have fewer and fewer children. The department, you know, SFUSD is kind of its own thing. And, you know, so there's not a whole lot that, you know, it's not a direct control. You know, I could be wrong on this one. Maybe you guys know. But I don't believe the mayor can fire the superintendent, and he certainly can't, you know, dictate terms to the teachers. But when it comes down to it, you know, the teachers are woefully underpaid. They are woefully underpaid. They're among the poorest paid teachers in California, and this is the most expensive county, if maybe Marin is. So this is something that, you know, some solution had to be reached.
And is that a piece of legislation put on by the Board of Supervisors, or is that – who put that one forward?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I would be shocked if it wasn't carried by a supervisor on behalf of the teachers union. Mm-hmm.
So education funding in the state of California, when Prop 98 passed and Prop 13 passed, funding for schools principally went away from the local level and went to the state level. And so the reason San Francisco in many respects gets hurt is because you get paid per little fanny that's in the seat during that day. So you get a piece of big chunk of state money, some federal money, and some local money. So if you have less and less kids, you don't get the critical mass to fund a lot of the things that you need to fund. So, you know, I think the initiative increases teacher salary by $5,500 as a national wave that's going across the country.
It's a start.
It's a no-brainer for that. But yeah. I think San Francisco is going to have to look at things really, really differently now with smaller and smaller kids. And as more and more expensive it is, like you see people making exoduses over to Oakland. Actually, our schools are getting a lot better. We're getting a lot of smart San Francisco kids that are coming across the Bay. But, I mean, they're going to have to really fundamentally look at the structure of the school with such a small population.
And it might be more than the caller wanted, but Sean's right. And San Francisco also has the highest percentage of kids in private schools, and that hurts you as well. And also when you have charter schools making incursions into the district, that pulls away resources because they're mandated to take buildings, and also they pull away students who, as Sean mentioned, would that's a compensation source from the state.
Sure. We have time for one or two more calls. We have Art on hold. Art, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your question.
I'm wondering about the race for the seat currently held by Nancy Pelosi. There is a primary, but you wouldn't know it by listening or watching or reading any of the San Francisco media. I think it's really a disservice to the voters not to have any coverage of the primary for Congressional District 12, which is Nancy Pelosi's. I only know about this race because I'm a volunteer for one of the candidates, but I'd like to know what your panel thinks of that race and if they have any thoughts about the candidates.
Well, interestingly, a couple of my students, I think, also volunteered on one of the campaigns and were asking me about that. I was always surprised. I'm like, oh, there's someone challenging Pelosi. I mean, the reason why it doesn't get much coverage is there's no chance she's going to lose. These are not serious candidates, unfortunately. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi is incredibly popular in San Francisco. And so while some people may wish that were not the case, I think media tends to focus on things where there is some element of competitiveness, and that's probably the right decision.
I would say I agree with the caller's sentiment. I would say that the coverage of Ryan and Shahid's campaign is probably on par with their chances. I would say that it's probably Ryan knows this. I've talked to him. Or rather, more accurately, I was at an event that he talked. And I think that he is someone that we'll be seeing down the road. I think that,
and
you know,
that's a Pelosi challenger.
Yeah. The two fellas that, I mean, I was at an event where they were addressing the crowd. It was a forum put on by the public press, and you know, Nancy sent a surrogate, and Shahid Batar and Ryan Kojasta, I guess it is, you know, very engaging speakers, and they both have very good resumes. And the thing is, we'll be seeing them, but they're not going to win. And you know, every newspaper has to allot its resources more and more carefully these days.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller, William in Belvedere. William, are you there?
Yes, thank you very much. I live in Marin County, and I have to tell you that when we look at what's happening in San Francisco politics, where Uber and Lyft are clogging the streets, politicians are getting paid off with contributions from all sides. People are so angry with high-tech commuters, they're throwing scooters in front of the buses. The streets need to be hosed down due to feces on the sidewalks, and Airbnb people are fighting with their neighbors, and on and on. It's like it looks to us like, you might say, angry clowns in a coliseum. In our elections here, everything is quiet. There's a couple of issues, there's a couple of candidates, and it all seems very simple and quiet here, and exactly the opposite there. I wonder if the guests feel excited by what takes place there or depressed.
Well, I personally, since I studied, I love it, and I think it's very exciting. But I would also say that it's also very healthy. You know, politics is about a conflict of decision-making, ways to make decision-making through conflict. And oftentimes, if you don't have any conflict, like in Belvedere, for instance, there's not enough conflict to generate any kind of intensity of caring about it amongst the populace, that could be fine, but that might not be healthy. I mean, San Francisco has a diversity of different interests and types of people, different jobs, different backgrounds. That's going to lead to more conflict. And so it's exciting, but also healthy.
I'd say 90% of the country wouldn't want their local communities to be like San Francisco, but 90% of the country, if they had their choices, would move to San Francisco. So it's just a dynamic, vibrant place, intellectually dynamic, politically dynamic. And I will tell you, the people who protest the Google buses and all the tech people, how are you going to afford $100 million for child care? Is because the people who are renting these office spaces are going to fund that issue. I will tell you, San Francisco is a very vibrant community. How are you going to increase schools? You're going to have economic vitality. San Francisco is the dream of so many places around the country. They wish they had San Francisco's problems.
We're not dreaming of it at all.
But that's the difference between big city politics and small town politics. And Marin has we can get into the housing policies and other policies of Marin. You wouldn't have these problems because it's a low density place and it's by design, and that causes problems in and of itself. But you know, I mean, this is a big city. Big city politics are going to be a bit nastier, and I would imagine in other parts of the country, even nastier still. Jason and Sean and I could all talk about this. I don't see, for all the talk that there's not much policy difference in these candidates, and for all the talk that they're not ideologically different, I don't think that's a big deal. I think that the municipal issues are enough to get you going crazy. And, because we've all decided we don't need to have, you know, gender specific restrooms, and we don't need, and we can have same sex benefits and things like that. Those ideological points can be argued in the rest of the country, and people will slit each other's throats over it. We're going to kill each other over land use. We're going to kill each other over business regulation. And there's a lot of money and livability and legacies and, you know, sustainability involved. And it's enough. You know, it's high stakes.
Thanks so much for your call, William. I appreciate that.
I don't think anyone likes the feces, though. No. I don't think anybody likes the feces.
That's probably true.
And the heroin. I mean, the needles. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you take those issues away and you've got a pretty darn nice place.
I think that, you know what, we could fix a lot of that with more toilets and more boxes to put needles in. Let's try the easiest stuff first.
Well, as we have a little bit of time left and we want to wrap it up, if we wanted to help our listeners out, what's a great place to go to get some information about tomorrow's election if you haven't decided who you're going to vote for? Joe?
I'd say look at the League of Women Voters. They have a nonpartisan guide. I'd say look at the public press, which has taken it upon themselves to do eat your vegetables type of journalism. And they were kind enough to have me write three stories, which was always, you know, I appreciate greatly. I put in a self-serving pitch, check Mission Local. Tomorrow I'll have a column explaining, what to look for as election results turn in. So, you know, can at least, you know, put things in context. But again, League of Women Voters for the ballot guides, neutral. And public press for policy-driven stories about the candidates, all of the candidates, in fact.
Sean, Jason, any suggestions about for what voters can do for tomorrow?
I concur. The public press, I mean, people are attacking the press for fake news. But if you look at all of the stories that are in the, you know, East Bay newspapers and you're looking, it's very comprehensive, tells you exactly what's going on in very simple to understand formats, and the internet just makes it graphic, so it's terrific. You could spend 20 minutes and you know you need to know everything you pretty much need to know about this race.
Support your local press and newspapers, right, and websites. I would say one thing, which is, you know, talk to your friends about making sure they know there's an election and getting them out to vote. Talk to your children,
your
grandchildren.
They can still vote. You can still register to vote and vote at City Hall tomorrow.
Right. It's, and I think a lot of people don't know that in San Francisco. You can register to vote at City Hall and vote tomorrow even if you haven't registered yet. Right?
Remember, if you don't vote, you can't complain.
Yeah, that is very, very true. So our guests tonight have been Jason McDaniel, Associate Professor in Political Science at SF State, Joe Eskenazi, the Managing Editor at Mission Local and a former writer and editor for SF Examiner and SF Magazine, and Sean Walsh from the Public Policy Institute of California and a former advisor to two California governors. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb, Max Solmsen, and Marcus Kawaja. Join us next week as we speak to Kelly Corrigan, who's coming out with a new book, I believe. This is your host, Grace Wan. Thanks so much for listening. Go out and vote tomorrow, right, everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Good night and have a great week.